I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. John Burnett reported on NPR recently that immigrants fleeing gang violence in Central America are streaming across the U.S.-Mexico border just as they did 2 years ago looking for asylum. Back in 2014, President Obama used executive actions to allow immigrants who have entered the country as children or who have children who are American citizens to apply for temporary work permits and avoid deportation, at least for now. Those orders are before the U.S. Supreme Court after being challenged by 26 states. Meanwhile, President Obama has been criticized because of raids to round up and deport undocumented immigrants. He's also called on the country to resettle 10,000 Syrian refugees. And as we all know, Donald Trump has called for all undocumented immigrants to be deported if he becomes president. We asked Michael Matza to join us. He's a Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer. He has been covering immigration. He's also a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, used to report from the Middle East for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Michael Matza, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And I should say to our listeners, we're going to begin by talking about some of the things that are happening here locally. And then we have another guest who's going to join us about halfway through. And we'll be talking about this case before the U.S. Supreme Court and some other national issues. We are here in Philadelphia. Philadelphia, Michael, is a sanctuary city. What does that mean?
It means that the mayor of Philadelphia has asked the local police not to participate in rounding up people who may be undocumented, that is a federal role. And in order to keep Philadelphia safe and have immigrants feel that they can report crimes and so on and so forth, he feels that there's enough tools available to federal law enforcement agents through Immigration and Customs Enforcement that they do not need the Philadelphia police participation in that or the Philadelphia prison participation in that.
And there are other cities, obviously, San Francisco and some others that are also sanctuary cities.
Yes. I mean, it's a term. It's kind of a term of art. It's not really clearly defined thing. It just basically means that the federal obligation remains the federal obligation and the cities are not going to participate.
You had a story recently about some concern in this city that there would be raids by the federal government, I guess organized by ICE?
Yes.
Round up, if I can use that word, right. People who are in the city illegally. What is this about?
What this is about is you mentioned it in your introduction that tens of thousands of people have come across our southern border fleeing violence and political corruption in mostly El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And the ones that have come since 2014 have been prioritized. These are largely women and their children have been prioritized for removal as a way of trying to send the message back to those countries that, you know, just because you get here, it doesn't mean you're going to be able to stay. The new sanctuary movement of Philadelphia, which is a group of faith-based supporters for immigrants, has created a hotline for people who fear that they're about to be raided. Their point is that this is really a humanitarian crisis. These are people seeking asylum. These are people fleeing violence in their countries the same way Syrian refugees are fleeing from a broken country, and that we're applying a border security solution to what is really a humanitarian problem.
How did somebody, let's say, who went across the U.S.-Mexico border in 2014, how did they end up in Philadelphia?
Well, in many cases, they have family members who are already here. There's jobs sometimes that they know are available, and they just make their way up through the country. Mm. You know, I mean, very often, though, people they didn't sneak into the border. They came across the border and basically surrendered seeking asylum.
We saw those photographs, right?
Yes. And So it wasn't a matter of catching them. It was a matter of they kind of threw themselves into the arms of law enforcement. Law enforcement then, you know, dockets them for court cases. And in some cases, they're housed in Texas. There are two family detention centers in Texas. And we have one in Pennsylvania, which is called the Burks Family Center. Mm-hmm. And that has been the subject of a long-running battle to try and get it closed.
I want to pick up on Burks, but I'm interested in these raids. There were some raids earlier this year, not in Philadelphia, that were carried out.
That's right.
What happened?
In January, again, as part of this plan to try and, disincentivize people from coming, the government did a weekend of raids in mostly Georgia and North Carolina and Texas, I believe. And they got about 121 people over a weekend. And then there was a big outcry against this, and the government sort of ceased doing that in terms of targeted raids against these recent arrivals. It's the recent arrivals that, you know, that are targeted. And but about 3 or 4 weeks ago, Reuters got a hold of an internal ICE document saying that they were going to amp that same plan up again. And it created a lot of anxiety in a lot of places, including Philadelphia, which is why the New Sanctuary Movement said that they would try and help people. And basically what they said they would do is you call us and we'll show up, we'll pray, we'll bear witness to what's happening, we'll photograph what's happening. And, they're trying to use moral suasion to sort of, change policy.
So this was something that Reuters wrote about and got people upset.
Yeah,
and
Reuters
concerned.
Reuters seemed to get a leak or look at an internal document, and that's what that sort of redounded around the country, including in Philadelphia.
I mean, when we're talking about raids, I mean, it is what Donald Trump is talking about. I mean, he's talking on a much grander scale.
Oh yeah, he wants to deport all 11 million people, which is impractical. And so.
Yeah. Well, have there been raids? I mean, as you said, this was leaked. They thought it might happen in May or June.
To my knowledge, in Philadelphia, it hasn't really happened. That what may be happening are the standard enforcement operations that ICE runs could be interpreted as a raid or something like that. But to my knowledge, something triggered by what was revealed through the Reuters reporting hasn't happened yet in Philadelphia, but the advocates are sort of preparing in case it does.
In case it does. I mean, it does create an optics situation, doesn't it? I mean, just the
– Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're talking about women and children.
Yes, it does. That's exactly right. In the case of, the people who are fleeing what they call the triangle countries in Central America, their daughters are being – when they reach – puberty, they're being told they have to become the girlfriends of gang leaders. Their sons are being forced into recruitment. If they don't join the gang, then they'll be possibly killed. It's very serious.
What is the asylum process? And we'll be talking later on about President Obama saying we need to find homes, I guess, for people seeking asylum from Syria. But if someone is fleeing the kind of violence that we hear in certain countries in Central America, do they not qualify for asylum?
Well, the process, an immigration lawyer could probably tell you better than I, but the process is that once you ask for asylum, you're given what's called a credible fear hearing. It's the complicating part of this is that people can say that they're fleeing violence when maybe they're not, and we are very far away from the countries in which they're saying they have this problem. So how do we know? And so we have a system set up for trying to establish whether they have a credible fear. If they have a credible fear, they can then sort of move through the process of going to immigration court and try and win an asylum case. But the problem is that you don't have the right to a lawyer, unlike, criminal proceedings here, where if you don't have a lawyer, one will be appointed for you and so on and so forth. For immigrants, they don't have that right. And it's been shown that without lawyers, people really don't win their cases. Like 90% of the people without lawyers lose.
Because how do you navigate the system without someone to help you?
Right. And on the other side is a lawyer for the government who's an official prosecutor who knows the ins and outs of the system. So there is a movement to try and see if, mm-hmm. certainly for children, see if we can get mandatory lawyers for kids in the immigration system.
You mentioned the policy of trying to prevent people from coming. But as I was reading John Burnett, I mentioned him in my intro, who's been covering this from Texas, saying many people are coming back. That message doesn't seem to be working. And I think that even the head of the Department of Homeland Security even went to some of these countries to say, don't send your children, don't come to America. But it's not. Doesn't seem to be resonating.
I was in Honduras 2 years ago for a story, and I did see some of these posters and public service campaigns saying it's quite dangerous. Don't come. What they were stressing at that point was not that once you enter you'll be thrown out, but they were stressing it is a very dangerous, arduous, bad things can happen to you on the way. Don't go. But for people who are facing what they think are life and death situations. I sometimes think you could put a flaming moat between us and our southern border, between the interior of the United States and our southern border, and people will find a way to cross it because they are literally running for their lives.
Mm. You mentioned this Berks facility. There are several of these facilities. They're for families. Yes?
Right. Yes. The one in Berks holds about 100 people, and they were trying to expand it. It has been the subject of some lawsuits about whether it's licensed to do what it's actually doing. At one point, they were saying it's a facility meant sort of for like for people who are adjudicated delinquent and not, its original creation was for something like that. And it's not really meant to hold people who haven't been convicted of anything yet and are just awaiting, a court appearance. And certainly putting, young children in that environment is not a good place. There was a case of an institutional rape that was documented there within the past year and a half. It's a place that is really on the radar screen of the advocates, and they're really trying to get it closed down.
I mean, how does someone end up in Berks facility or end up in, in Kensington in Philadelphia? I mean, what defines that?
Sometimes they transfer people from the two facilities in Texas. There are some rules on how long you can keep people. And so sometimes people get transferred from Texas up to Berks County. And as for how people move internally and get from what seems a faraway place to here, there's a network of doing it,
And like an underground railroad in a way.
I don't know that it's quite an underground railroad, but people don't fly because they can't really fly. But you can take a bus, You can and in some cases, if you've paid someone to help you get into the country, that known as a coyote, that person is also helping for your internal transit. But there are also a lot of times when people get ripped off by coyotes.
That's Michael Matza. He writes about immigration for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And in this hour of Radio Times, getting an update on a number of immigration-related issues. 1-888-477-9499, the phone number to call. You can also email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Michael Matza about some regional or local immigration-related issues. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Mike, you had a really interesting piece just a month or so ago about Hazleton, Pennsylvania, about 10 years ago. The then mayor of Hazleton, Lou Barletta, was concerned about the numbers of immigrants coming into his city and had a series of I guess,
local ordinances.
Thank you very much. Local ordinances to address that issue. Can you take us back 10 years?
Well, what you had in Hazleton was a former coal town that was, suffering from the sort of the changes in the economy. And as a result, the housing was affordable and so on and so forth. And people, and mostly Dominican immigrants were. Many of them were not coming directly from the Dominican Republic. They had been in New York for years and years, and they were moving down to Hazleton and sort of changing the nature of Hazleton a little bit and changing the population of Hazleton. They, in many cases, took over a deteriorated downtown and opened shops and actually helped to revive the economy. But there was, you know, what is also often called the Latino threat narrative. And that was there had been some problems related to some of the people who had come. There had been a killing that was attributed to undocumented immigrant. And as a result, Barletta was trying to get through his city council ordinances against renting to anybody who wasn't documented.
Targeting the landlord.
Targeting the landlord, exactly. And, you know, this became complicated because landlords were sort of saying, how do I really know exactly what standard of proof am I going to apply? And so it became kind of ground zero for, toughness on undocumented immigrants. Lou Dobbs, the famous Lou Dobbs, had Lou Barletta on night after night after night. And Barletta, managed to raise his profile to the point where he's now in Congress and has endorsed Donald Trump. But Lou Barletta, in some ways, was the original Donald Trump in terms of, getting a raising his profile on the issue of being tough on undocumented immigrants.
So what's Hazleton like today?
I went back and spent time there. It is very interesting to see. There was a time, 10 years ago when outside a bar, people were hanging banners that said, we don't serve drinks here to anybody who's not documented. And it was a very kind of hostile environment. You go there now and there's a mercantile building in downtown that feels almost like you're in Miami in terms of the kind of the Latino flavor of the multi-service centers and the insurance companies and the other things that are there. Geisinger Health System, which operates down there, has huge billboards in Spanish, encouraging people to come to the walk-in clinics. It seems much more accommodating and welcoming. And the population is close to, I think, about half Latino now. After I wrote that story, I did get a lot of commentary from local people thinking that I didn't spend enough time there. I didn't really know how devastated it is to have your town taken over by a Latino population. And but when I was there, I didn't feel that sense. But
you talked to the police chief. What did he say?
The former police chief basically said very often the newcomers were victims of crime. They were not perpetrators of crime, and that he kind of reminded people that, people who were saying that we never had this kind of crime before. He was recalling that there was a time in Hazleton's history when there was a kind of mafia type crimes that were happening. There were fire bombings and things that happened. And his attitude was, if people think this never happened before in Hazleton, they have a short memory.
Wow. One more thing, and then we've got our second guest who will be joining us. This was an article you had. It was a couple of months ago, but it really caught my eye. And this has to do – am I looking at the wrong piece of paper? I might be. I have so many pieces of paper here with your name on it, Michael Matza. But it has to do with people who have green cards, 8 million of them.
Yes.
So they're here legally.
In the country, yes. A green card gives you legal permanent residency. And after – having one for 5 years, you can with no incidents, you can apply for citizenship. I did a story a few months ago about a program that was helping these people apply for their citizenship and try and get it in time to be able to vote in the November election. That one of the things that's been a fallout of this crazy election season is that people who have been sitting on green cards and thinking that there's really no need to pay the money to get their citizenship or go through the process have decided they want the franchise, they want to vote. And so an exceptionally large number have actually decided to take that step.
And is there, what do we have, 3 or 4 months before the next, general election?
Yeah, I think you have to have your citizenship sometime in October in order to, I forget all the timetables, But when I was writing about it, I think it was back in April, and it was out in Kennett Square, where there's a large Latino population that works in the mushroom industry. And some of those people have green cards, and they just have not bothered to step forward. There were lawyers volunteering their time out there to help them do that.
That is Michael Matza, and he's a Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer, and he's been writing most recently about immigration, focusing largely on what's been happening here in the Delaware Valley. Joining us now is Sungmin Kim, and she's congressional reporter for Politico. And Sungmin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on.
Nice to have you with us. And again, to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Spending this hour talking about immigration, because frankly, there is a lot going on. Sungmin, I do want to talk about this case. It's before the U.S. Supreme Court. Talk with both you and also Michael. This is the U.S. v. Texas. What is this case about, Sungmin?
So this is going to be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, case that the Supreme Court takes up this year. And this concerns this very big, sweeping, and very controversial program that President Obama announced back in November 2014. Basically, what it does is that if you are here without legal status, but yet you've been here for at least 5 years, you have a U.S. citizen child or a child who holds a green card, and you've stayed mostly out of trouble, and you go through background checks, you can stay here temporarily. You won't be targeted for deportation, and you can actually work legally as well. This came after Congress failed to do immigration reform in 2013-2014. President Obama was under a lot of pressure to act on his own to stop these deportations, and he eventually did. But Texas, and joined by 25 other states, challenged that program in court, and that's why we are where we are right now at the U.S. Supreme Court.
And we're talking about DAPA, Michael, and DACA.
Yes, the deferred action for the parents of Americans and deferred action for childhood arrivals. And, you know, as Sungmin explained, these are executive actions by the president, which are in effect like prosecutorial discretion decisions. He hasn't legalized these people. Right. He's basically given them a reprieve from deportation. And that was part of the argument before the Supreme Court. I went down there to hear it. And, you know, part of the argument was that by executive action, the president was just usurping a congressional power to decide who gets to stay in America. And the our U.S. government answer was, no, he hasn't legalized people. He hasn't given them full legal status. He's just told them that for the time being, you can stay and you can work. And that's just a reprieve. It's not a grant of an open pass.
Is Pennsylvania one of those states? One of those 26 states?
No, it's not.
It's not.
It's mostly 26 Republican governors who joined together. And you know, there's some suggestion that it may just be the people are principled, but they're also happy to thwart Obama's agenda.
And we should say with any executive action, once Obama's out of office, then it doesn't hold.
That's correct. I mean, it could hold or it could be rescinded. It could even be rescinded by Obama, you know, but that's not going to happen.
No. So, I mean, let me go back to you. I know you were at the court as well. And again, we are talking about a court with 8 members. So the possibility of a 4-4 decision. What did you hear coming from the justices?
I thought what was really interesting to me, I think everyone was watching kind of the usual suspects in these cases. We were all very closely watching Chief Justice Roberts and also Justice Kennedy. It did seem like the 4 members of the more of the liberal members of the court were willing to side with the Obama administration that, yes, they did have the power to do these programs. And no, another issue focused on during the court arguments was an issue called standing. So basically, did Texas and the other states even have the right to bring this case in the first place? Mm. And the administration says, no, they did not. And the 4 liberal justices seem to indicate that way. But we do know that if there is a 4-4 tie, the lower court's decisions stand, which means that, you know, these programs will be blocked. So the focus really on the focus really right now is on what Justice Roberts is thinking right now, Justice Kennedy is thinking right now. I remember Justice Roberts seemed to take a pretty skeptical view towards the administration on the standing argument. It seemed like maybe he was agreeing with the Texas and the states there a little bit. Justice Kennedy also seems skeptical about the broad use of executive powers, but you know, we're all kind of reading the tea leaves here, so we'll just have to see once the decision comes out, most likely this month.
I was going to say, well, most likely this month. Michael, you want to add something?
As Sungmin points out, the issue of standing in Texas, they were basically saying if Obama's actions stand, something like 500,000 people would be then eligible for Texas driver's licenses, and that was going to raise, that was going to cost Texas a lot of money, and as a result, that was the injury it was going to suffer. That's why it had standing to go into court and try and block it. That was the argument. I remember Justice Sotomayor sort of taking on that argument and saying, well, everybody knows that when you go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, it's an aggravating situation. And it takes forever. And, Texas really is – any money that Texas wants to spend on this is really a self-inflicted injury, because they could just go ahead and just continue to process driver's licenses the way they always have. And it might take a little bit longer, but, you know, c'est la vie.
Sungmin, I wonder, too, whether – I mean, this is speculation here – whether this would then get – let's say it's 4-4 so that it upholds the injunction, that it could be once there's a ninth justice, it would make its way through the courts again and get re-argued?
Yes, that's been an option out there. You know, they could say they are – you know, they're divided – by an equally, or the decision is upheld by an equally divided court. However, they can also send back the case for re-argument for the next term. And that's clearly an option here, because we do, you know, this case has sweeping implications, not just for immigration, but also just the use of executive power. And so once the court does receive a ninth justice, which because of the Senate Republican blockade on nominee Merrick Garland right now, doesn't seem like it'll happen until at least early next year. This could be a case that comes back again next term.
Let me ask you, because you cover Congress, and this has been going on, I don't know, decades, can we say that? Certainly many years, the inability to come to some kind of agreement about what to do about the, 11, 12 million people who are here illegally, the undocumented immigrants. From your reading of Congress, is there any movement on this, any middle ground that people can rally around?
I think the closest we came to a big compromise, that big middle ground, was in 2013 and early into 2014, when there was that big momentum on Capitol Hill to do immigration reform. Remember, right after the 2012 presidential election, we saw candidate Mitt Romney lose the Latino vote and the Asian vote by significant margins. And top Republicans and the Republican National Committee all said, we have to do immigration reform to fix this problem that we have with minority voters. It's supposed, you know, we know that according to polling, immigration is not the top issue for Latino voters, but it is a gateway issue. Which Republicans, you know, on Capitol Hill realized. We had the Senate pass a bill in 2013, but the House never really got there. And now just the president's executive actions, if you talk to Republicans, has really, you know, quote, poisoned the well for doing any kind of legislative reform. And talking about immigration on Capitol Hill has been very, very quiet since. There's some sense that maybe if there are similar election results this November, after this November's elections, considering the controversial comments that the Republican nominee, Mr. Donald Trump, has made, that maybe a similar dynamic can happen again this fall, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, and this, of course, the various comments that Donald Trump has said, including building a wall, deporting 11 or 12 million people, and then his more recent comments about an American-born judge who has Mexican heritage. Michael?
Yeah, I mean, the part that's so amazing about this is that the Republicans did a lot of soul searching after they lost the second time to Obama, and they came up with a kind of postmortem, and they said, you know, we do have to reach out to Latino populations, Asian populations, so on and so forth. And then their nominee has seemed to gone, you know, the polar opposite by slamming Mexicans as his opening salvo. And continuing now, you know, to claim that this federal judge who was born in the United States and just happens to be of Mexican heritage can't fairly hear, and should recuse himself. He can't fairly hear the Trump University case because Trump has said he wants to build a wall. Trump is then asked, well, you've also said that Muslims shouldn't come into the country. Could a Muslim judge act fairly? And apparently his answer was, well, maybe not. You know, maybe he has to recuse himself too.
How are those things, Sungmin? How's that, specifically, how is that playing in Congress?
Not too well. and my colleague and I talked to more than a dozen Senate Republicans yesterday. Yesterday was the first day that senators and members of the House returned to Capitol Hill after a week-long Memorial Day recess. And the general sense, I mean, there was widespread condemnation of those remarks, even from his most fervent endorsers. Clearly, these are very controversial comments from the presumptive nominee. No one on Capitol Hill supports them. However, the problem where Republicans are finding themselves is, how do you condemn those comments and yet still endorse him as the party's nominee? Right now, Senate Republicans do say, we disagree with those remarks, and yet we will still support him this fall. And that's just been the very difficult position they've been finding themselves in.
Well, we're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation, talking about immigration, the issue of immigration in all its various forms and guises. That's Sungmin Kim, and she's a congressional reporter for Politico and has been covering immigration. Also with us, Michael Matza. He's a Philadelphia Inquirer-based staff writer. He's been covering immigration as well. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break, including talking about Syrian refugees looking for asylum. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Sungmin Kim and also Michael Matza about immigration. Let me get Vikram from Lansdale to join our conversation. Vikram, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So my name is Vikram. I grew up in India. I came here to the San Jose area, got a degree in engineering, been here for about 15 years, and have worked in the San Jose area for companies that has created about 500 jobs. I want to remind the panel and the listeners as well that legal immigration is also an important piece of this. You know, when President Obama announced his executive actions in November 2014, one of the things that made the legal immigrant community jubilant was the fact that, you know, he promised to bring relief to high-skilled immigrants, which are stuck in green card backlogs. So these are doctors, researchers, engineers who've done everything right from a paperwork standpoint, but yet we don't have green cards. So what we're seeing in 2 years since, or 18 months since, is that not only fixes for illegal immigration community, which is, again, a very important issue and needs to be resolved, but it seems like fixes for that community are being prioritized over fixes for legal immigrants. And, you know, apart from that, even the regulations that are being announced, you know, in the draft form, the regulations that we see that are coming out are actually making situations, you know, really worse. And we can go into details, but, you know, I'm sort of get a sense of, you know, what the panel thinks about where's legal immigration stand in this whole, on this whole topic.
Vikram, I think it's an excellent question, and he's saying, Michael, and to you, Sungmin, which is that people who are here legally, as he is, feel as if they are taking a back seat to people who have come here illegally.
Well,
Michael?
I mean, this, I think, is why advocates for comprehensive immigration reform want the Congress to tackle the whole package, the package of people of Indian descent who are waiting a very long time because of the way our immigration system works versus people from other countries where we are admitting people quicker. That seems unfair, and there's also a debate about whether our immigration system should be family unification based. If you have family here and you want to join them, or should it be skill based? Should it be should we invite in or prioritize immigrants who bring higher education with them and bring the likelihood that they're going to somehow stimulate our economy more than people who are doing manual labor jobs. That's a big debate, and that's what Obama wants the Congress to take on, and Congress seems to keep punting on that one.
Vikram, let me put the same thing to our other guest, Sung Min. Why does it take so long? If someone is here legally, why does it take so long? Why is it so complicated to become an American citizen?
There's a saying that basically immigration law is second only to tax law as one of the most, basically the most complicated law in U.S. code. I mean, these are laws that have been in the books for years, and it's just always been such a complex, complicated web of regulations and processes that immigrants who want to come here legally have had to go through. I mean, one of the textbook cases that we always point to, if you're a citizen of the Philippines and you're trying to come here, basically, you know, wait in line and get here legally, the wait can be more than 20 years, essentially. Now, and which is why, you know, as Michael pointed out, that Congress has wanted to do comprehensive immigration reform in one big package. And now legal immigration reform has been less controversial than what to do with the 11 million who are here illegally. There's a lot of support from, you know, Republicans, especially those who believe that easier ways to come here legally boost economic growth. That's why a lot of Republicans are in favor of this. But, you know, it was kind of like that in the last Congress. If you don't get it in one big package, you're not going to get the legal reform. So it might be easier to move forward just on reforming H-1B visas or green cards. But yet everything has had to move together in one big package. And that's another hurdle right now in Congress.
Matthew?
Michael? The notion that there's one line and people need to wait in line, I think that's not a correct notion. As Sung Min pointed out, if you're from the Philippines, the line is 20 years long. That's because we have a sort of a weighted system that says we've had so many people from the Philippines, we've had so many people from India that are in distributing our visas, we distribute them to countries that are less represented in our population. And so if your country is overrepresented in our population, your wait is going to be longer. And so people think, well, it's just one line and people are cutting in line. It's so complicated and so troubled for the people who have to wait a long time.
And yet we are, you know, the cliche is we certainly are a nation of immigrants. It's one thing that really distinguishes us from so much of the rest of the world. And yet we make it so hard, both for people legally and illegally. It's such a curious situation.
Yeah. Well, we're a country that has we're a big magnet. It's a great place to be. It's a wonderful country. And then the question is, well, can we open our doors to anybody who wants to come? Well, no, we can't. We have to have a system.
So, I mean, let me ask you about the status of Syrian refugees requesting asylum. The president said he wanted something like 10,000 permitted. I'm not sure how many have been permitted, but where does that stand? And I know Michael wants to weigh in on this as well, and then we'll get back to our callers. But do you want to take this first, Sung Min?
Sure. So President Obama said, you know, almost, you know, well over half a year ago that he wanted to really, ramp up how many refugees from Syria that the United States was admitting. But right now, there's a great New York Times story about this recently. Right now, you know, the administration's goal was to resettle about 10,000 Syrian refugees in this fiscal year. But we're about 8 months into the effort, and the administration has admitted just over 2,500. So one-fourth of their goal with, you know, almost the year almost up. And a lot of that, they're trying, but a lot of that is factors beyond their control. Obviously, the vetting procedures for refugees are among the most stringent of any immigrant trying to come to the United States. So that just takes time. And obviously, there are difficult politics surrounding admitting refugees, considering all the rhetoric that arose after the terrorist attacks last fall in Europe. There was this vote in Congress last fall where Congress wanted to pass tougher vetting standards on refugees. refugees, and where the administration basically said these standards are so tough that we won't be allowed to admit any refugee in. And yet nearly 50 House Democrats supported this Republican proposal. So the politics in Congress are very tough on this one. And this has been a very difficult goal for the administration to achieve.
Talk about the lack of, I mean, you talked about, Michael, about there is no one line to get into the country. Can you expand on that?
Well, I mean, the thing with refugees, specifically from Syria, I think a lot of times the general public tends to confuse undocumented immigrants and refugees. These are people who've been vetted by the UN High Commission on Refugees. They've often spent years in refugee camps waiting to get resettled. If that was somebody's plan to infiltrate the United States, it's very illogical that they would do it that way. And these people are really highly highly questioned and highly inspected before they can come. Canada, on the other hand, has said that it wants to take 25,000, and I've also seen a figure of 50,000. I don't know how well they're doing in terms of their reception, but I think they're on a pace faster than we are.
Hmm. Let me see what Andrew from West Philadelphia has to say. Andrew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say briefly that I think this isn't only an issue that affects strictly immigrants or strictly people of Hispanic origin or people who come from different countries in general, but I think it's a question that affects working people in the United States, whether you're born here or born in a different country. One thing that's commonly left out of this entire discussion is the fact that undocumented immigrants cannot legally join labor unions, and it makes it extremely expensive for labor unions and labor organizers to reach out to this population because they have to live in the shadows. When undocumented workers are subject to all sorts of different abuses by their employers, you know, the employers basically, you know, hold it over their head saying, you know, if you try to organize against us, if you try to put an end to us, we'll just call, you know, the immigration enforcement and throw you all out of the country and separate your families and so on and so forth. And so I think, you know, it's really imperative for all working people to stand with this community and stand with undocumented immigrants in place for amnesty for all these people, because if there's a situation where a huge chunk of working people, 11 million working people in this country, aren't able to organize, aren't able to fight for their rights legally above the table, then that drags wages and living standards down for all workers, because employers are able to pit undocumented workers against workers that have legal status.
Andrew,
I
appreciate the call to Radio Times. Michael, let me put that to you. I mean, he's basically saying by keeping these people, you know, undocumented, they can't organize, they end up sort of depressing wages and things like that. Is there some truth to that, too?
Well, yeah, I think there is some truth to that. And I think they are vulnerable to the kinds of insecurities and, you know, an employer who could take it. It goes both ways. An employer could take advantage of them. And, you know, they're also possibly willing to work for lower wages, which is, you know, affecting everybody. Mm-hmm. So it is the employment thing is a complicated issue.
So, I mean, I've also heard the argument that these either legal or illegal immigrants take jobs away from, you know, natural-born Americans. Truth to that?
Opponents of immigration reform have tried to make that argument, but supporters of comprehensive immigration reform point to studies that show bolstering immigration both on, you know, the so-called high-end side and on the lower-end side kind of has a bigger, much economic growth generating effect, which helps the economy as a whole. So it depends on kind of what your outlook is on whether immigration is good for the country or not. I think you can, you know, if you do oppose it, you can look at it as, look, there are, you know, these are jobs. We're in a time where the economy is still clearly recovering, where many people who want jobs don't have them. However, you know, there are also, you know, studies looking at saying, you know, but it's better for the economy as a whole. There have been some stories, however, where, you know, specific employers have been reportedly taking, you know, using the immigration programs of sorts to kind of undercut U.S. citizen employees. I think we're all focused on these legal challenges against Disney, where, you know, American citizen workers were laid off, and Disney then they had to train their foreign-born replacements who are getting paid lower rates than these citizen employees were. So there are definitely examples out there of this alleged abuse of the system.
Michael, anything you want to add to that?
The only other thing I would add is that very often when someone is living illegally and working here, they may still be getting a paycheck that withholds that does federal withholding. That money goes into the Social Security system. Those people will never be able to pull that money back out of the Social Security system. And there have been some studies that show I think it's in the order of billions of dollars that end up in the Social Security system by people who technically shouldn't be working here, but are helping prop up our Social Security system.
In fact, you wrote something. I'm quoting you again, Michael Matza. You wrote something earlier this year. Immigrants living illegally in the U.S. paid $11.6 billion in state and local taxes in 2013. Not federal taxes, but state and local taxes. Still a lot of money.
Right.
Let me get let me read a comment from Jose. He said, this issue seems to be more political than anything else. Lack of immigration reform speaks to the fact that our government is dysfunctional and refuses to do its due diligence. Sungmin, you cover Congress. Anything you want to say back to Jose?
I think Congress is dysfunctional is a very common refrain that we hear these days, and there is some truth to that. But I think traditionally, throughout the years, immigration has been a very difficult, contentious issue. It's not just in 2013 that you had this dramatic political fight over doing immigration reform. We saw this in 2006, 2007 under the Bush administration. We saw the big fight under Reagan back in 1986. So this is going to be an issue that's just, fraught with, politics that has been for some time. We see how immigration is actually probably, one of the most, if not the most contentious policy issues that's being litigated on the campaign trail for most of the primary, and I'm sure for most of the general election. The Republican side, led by Donald Trump, has taken a very hardline stance against immigrants and immigration and illegal immigration. On the Democratic side, you have, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders saying they would go even further than what President Obama did on executive action on immigration. Secretary Clinton has also pledged to, take immigration reform in the first 100 days of her term. So you see how the two different parties are prioritizing it and how they're doing it. And it's going to be a very contentious issue for the next several months.
You agree with that, Michael?
Yes, I do. But I also will recall that President Obama said he wanted to make it a high priority issue when he came into office. And 8 years later, this is where
we are. And it's interesting that he's both been criticized from the left and the right. I mean, he has been called the deporter in chief.
That's exactly right. I mean, as for his legacy, it's going to be mixed. On the one, there have been years during his administration when more than 400,000 people got deported. Arguably, he's enforced immigration law more than any of his predecessors. And on the flip side, frustrated by Congress not taking action, he took action with executive action. And, we've aired that out in the past hour.
We have. Sungmin, we're almost out of time. Do you have a thought about the Obama legacy on this issue?
I think mixed is just the perfect term for it. And clearly, to his best effort, he tried to push Congress on immigration reform, doing basically almost everything Congress asked of him. Republicans kind of signaled that, too much White House involvement may hurt this cause among Republicans. So the president kind of kept his head down for a little bit until reform was just not going to happen and it wasn't going to happen anymore. Obviously, his high number of deportations are a real, terrible sore spot for advocates and for Democrats. And at the same time, he took this sweeping executive actions that were unprecedented basically in scope, and he was a victory for that. But now it really depends on the Supreme Court and how they rule.
Well, my thanks to both of you for walking us through this really complicated but such an important issue. Sungmin Kim, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
It was great for us as well. Congressional reporter for Politico, Michael Mazza, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You're welcome. And he's a Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer, and he has been covering immigration. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us in this first of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.